RPG Lessons Learned. When the game is over, when your players are gone, that's when lessons are learned. We're at RPGLL Podcast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, rpglpodcast@gmail.com, and check us out online at rpglessonslearned.com.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of RPG Lessons Learned, the show where you can learn from our mistakes. I am one of your featured co-hosts, Tanner, and I'm here with your main host, Dusty. How's it going, Dusty?
Hey, Tanner, how's it going?
Oh, I cannot complain legally. And we are going to be talking about a game that I ran for you not too far back called, I like to call it Motor City Greens and Blues, which is our one-on-one kind of Trail of Cthulhu hack that was set in 1970s Detroit.
And that was a super fun game.
Oh, good. I'm glad. I remember we gave it like a 7 out of 10 at the time. So I'm glad that that you haven't thought less of it as time has gone on.
No, my memories are actually quite warm and fuzzy. It was really just the end that we'll get to. I feel like I do that a lot. I'm like, we'll get to it in the end. Let me not do that. Let me just say it was combat that threw me. Yeah. We'd had a great mystery, and right out of the gate, first thing in the podcast I'll say is the combat at the end felt out of place. It felt like a fist fight at the end of an episode of CSI.
Right.
It just felt strange.
Yeah. Yeah. So this kind of goes back to, we were talking about when you ran Books and Bullets for me a couple episodes back, we had talked about, how hard mysteries are to run. And we had also talked about at the end, I had this D20 Call of Cthulhu book that I brought up, and I made a big show about how cool it was that there was a setting in the back for like, what does Call of Cthulhu look like throughout every decade of the 20th century. And so that kind of got the ball rolling for us to want to play in. I mean, like, I've never played in a game set in the 1970s before. Had you?
I have not.
Yeah. So I think I kind of got the ball rolling for us, and that's kind of where this started. But yeah, it was a bit of a hack of Trail of Cthulhu, which uses the gumshoe system, which I talk a big game about. I know there are official one-to-one hacks for Trail of Cthulhu, but I kind of just did my own thing and set it up so that we could work like we have been with one player and one GM. But yeah, that's sort of where this started. What did you think about the rule set? I know I talked a big game about gumshoe. Did I overhype it for you? Because I remember at the end of that Books and Bullets, you were like, I'm not running another mystery until I've read gumshoe cover to cover. Is that still your feeling?
It is. I think gumshoe's got a great philosophy. I think the mechanics are fine. I think it's really more the philosophy of gumshoe that, hey, if you're in... there's these things called core clues, and if you're in the right spot and you have the right skill, you get the core clue. That philosophy makes a ton of sense. And the mechanics, I like that they're D6 based. I've got a soft spot for D6 mechanics. The weird polyhedrals, like, it's fun. Like, I love a good D20 game, but if a game has D6s and only D6s, I just have always thought that's rad.
Yeah, me too.
So I dig gumshoe for all those reasons. I don't think it's... I don't think it's the Excalibur that I was hoping it would be with regard to mysteries. How to set up a mystery, like the advice, I don't know what website it is, Pellegrin Press, I think, maybe. They've got Gumshoe 101, Gumshoe, actually Player Gumshoe 101, GM Gumshoe 101, and GM Gumshoe 102. And GM Gumshoe 102 is how to make an adventure. And it's 2 pages, and pretty much it's like, figure out a mystery and then run it.
Right.
It's like, you didn't help me. You didn't give me the steps for like laying out a mystery.
Right. So, and it's almost like designing like a puzzle or something, you know, like it's very easy to kind of procedurally create a dungeon, but I just feel like there's just some magic, something lost in the sauce between that and like a mystery game, that it's really hard to like give step-by-step instructions on how to make a good mystery. I don't know, maybe like John Grisham has a thing, a document somewhere sitting around, because he can write 30 books a year or whatever, but
you know,
John Grisham.
It's funny you say that. I bet John Grisham, he doesn't call it the conspiriment, but I bet it's the conspiriment, because in John Grisham novels, you're never uncovering just a mystery who killed who. You're always uncovering a conspiracy.
Mm-hmm.
At least having read The Rainmaker and a few other John Grisham novels, The Pelican Brief, of course, in my vast experience with John Grisham, that's the way I see it, is it always seems to be conspiracies.
Yeah, it's formulaic. I don't know. Maybe there's just needs to be a new formula for tabletop mysteries. Maybe that's what it's coming down to.
So speaking of Dungeon Crawls, Tanner, we joke about your checklist that you've admittedly gleaned from other sources, but the checklist for Dungeon Crawls, what's the checklist like for investigations? Is there a checklist that can help us figure out how to put together an adventure?
That's a really great question. I guess we were kind of dancing around that, right? That like there are, like, I mean, you're going to have a good supporting cast, right? And you're going to have a good set of suspects and an interesting crime and stuff like that. But it, the mystery genre is so much bigger than the quote unquote dungeon crawling genre, you know, because if you say, oh, I like mysteries, you know, are you talking John Grisham? Are you talking Agatha Christie? Are you talking, you know, the recent like Knives Out, those two movies where the mystery is arguably not what the movies are about at all? You know, like, I feel like mystery is such a bigger can of worms that I think you really have to kind of dial in at what flavor of mystery when it comes to making a checklist, right?
That's fair.
But yeah, I mean, I tried to hit some big things here. So I tried to have an interesting crime that had a bunch of different parts that you had to kind of piece together. I tried to have a couple of interesting suspects. I tried to do something that, you know, the scene of the crime wasn't quite what it appeared to be at first glance. And then, of course, because we were playing Trail of Cthulhu, I had to have a Lovecraftian twist, you know, coming up. But yeah, so I guess maybe I can, it'll help for discussions if I talk about the sort of basic structure of what the session was about. I don't plan on putting this out there or anything, so... but it was basically there. You were a cop in 1970s Detroit, and you stumbled across a crime scene that looked like a biker gang murder. And then you kind of found out that there are these three different people who are all involved in a separate part of a money counterfeiting scheme. And this investigative journalist got wind of it, and the counterfeiting scheme was going towards buying artifacts to keep a thing in a lake asleep instead of letting it wake up. That's sort of the basics of it, right?
It is. And I got to uncover that kind of piece by piece. And despite that reveal at the end that he was really trying to do this good thing and keep this Leviathan, for lack of a better term, asleep, I didn't care. My guy needed to do his job and bring this guy in for murder.
Cool motive, still murder, right?
Yep, exactly.
Yeah, that's always tough. So, I mean, obviously you knew that we were sitting down to play Trail of Cthulhu. Was waiting for the Cthulhu thing to show up like kind of a pain in the butt? Or did you like the suspense of like, I don't know when this is going to get weird?
No, I love mixing Cthulhu with other stuff. In fact, I backed a Kickstarter about a year ago, I think, called Brindlewood Bay, mm-hmm. that mixes Cthulhu with Murder, She Wrote. And my daughter and my wife love Murder, She Wrote. I was so excited to tell her, hey, I backed this Kickstarter. We're going to get this book in probably like a year, and I'm going to be able to run mysteries for you in the Jessica Fletcher Murder, She Wrote universe with Cthulhu. And my wife was like, oh god, why does everything have to be mixed with Cthulhu? I can't get enough Cthulhu. It's like lemon pepper.
Yeah,
I can't have enough lemon pepper chicken and rice. That's basic tastes.
That's so funny. Was it a weakness then that the Cthulhu stuff really only kind of came in towards the end of the adventure, or would you have rather it kind of hinted at, and would you have rather the lemon pepper kind of sprinkle over the whole dish instead of just say for dessert?
Now that you ask me, I'm torn. I love the original Scooby-Doo. And as a skeptic, and frankly, as an atheist, I really enjoyed that the monster in Scooby-Doo was always a person. Mm-hmm. And the new Scooby-Doo shows that actually have real ghosts and real zombies, I'm always like, oh, you're missing the point. So would I like this better if there was no Cthulhu? No. I also like the X-Files. which had mostly a vanilla investigation right up until the end where the weird stuff came out and was unexplainable. And I was expecting that, and it fit. You know, it, now that you're saying it, if I gave you one bit of advice, it would be do what X-Files does and start and end on the Cthulhu. Mm-hmm. You ended on it. Maybe if there had been like some kind of weird thing at the beginning and then a mundane investigation and then more weird stuff at the end, it would have really used that X-Files formula.
Yeah, I think from all of the written Cthulhu adventures that I've seen, at least, and I've only really seen the well-regarded ones, I think that's kind of their formula too, where it starts with something a little bit unexplained. I mean, that's how a good mystery should start, right? With questions. And but adding that extra layer would have been good, making a little Lovecraftian sandwich out of the adventure instead of just kind of saving it all for the end.
Can I confess something to you about how terrible a GM I am?
Sure. That's the whole point of the show, right?
Yeah, unrelated to this adventure. In classic Call of Cthulhu, I'm terrible at transitioning from the investigation phase where you're like in the library looking up news articles to the actual adventure. So in the famous The Haunting, Mr. Corbett's house.
Yep.
There's that whole beginning part where there's all of these articles you can uncover. There's all these newspaper articles and listings, and I forget what all the handouts are, but there's all these handouts that you can discover before you go to the house and you run that part of the adventure. And then the rest of the adventure is in the house. I'm terrible at like telegraphing to my players, hey, you're done. You've got all the handouts. Get out of the library and go put yourself in danger. I can never make that transition, ever.
Yeah, and I think maybe subconsciously I'm kind of the same way, because I feel like I don't write mysteries where the answer is in the library, you know? And I think a lot of Lovecraft stories are like that, you know? But a lot of Lovecraft, like you mentioned, like Call of Cthulhu adventures are like that. And I don't know. Maybe it's because I don't want to write 2,000 words of handouts to hand to people for my like a one-shot game, but like that stuff always seemed more like it works in like a published adventure than, I don't know. If you're listening to this and you have large sections of your home Call of Cthulhu game take place in the library, let us know how it works, because I think we're both kind of baffled by it, right?
Yeah, and specifically, I get how that part works, but specifically, how do you get them out of the library to the actual adventure?
I guess you just have to give them like kind of, I mean, we've talked about this, like every good one shot should have a timer on it, right? That like, if you don't do this by this time, something bad will happen. And I guess you just have to make sure that they know that the info that they get is actionable intelligence. It's something they can do something with and set them on their way. But yeah, maybe you just have to have the right group to get that too, you know?
Or to your point, limit it. Yeah, everyone gets to make two checks before you get to the adventure, but then we're starting the adventure.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. So we had this red herring kind of in the adventure, and I kind of like half wrote them as a red herring. I generally don't like red herrings in tabletop adventures, but this one at least kind of looped back to the main mystery. And it was this this biker gang who was kind of involved, and you know, like I said, the crime was kind of set up to look like a biker gang hit. How did we feel about the red herring?
I dug the red herring. If there had been too many red herrings, I would not have enjoyed it.
Okay.
I would have felt like it turned into a guessing game. But I think one was perfect.
Okay, that's good. So yeah, maybe if you're gonna run a game, you know, really kind of use those sparingly, I would say, because it's one thing if like you're watching an episode of CSI and there's a suspect that isn't what they seem, and you get to kind of learn more about the characters on the way, and then that kind of points up, but like it's really easy to feel like your time is wasted at a tabletop game, you know, if it's a true dead end, you know. And I tried to make it so that this one wasn't at least a dead end. He could at least, you know, point the finger at somebody else.
I guess I'm in the mood to add a lot of things that I'm going to edit out later, but a couple things. One, my first exposure to the phrase red herring was fun fact from the New Adventures of Scooby-Doo, where they literally had a character named Red Herring that Freddy always accused of being the criminal.
Kind of great.
Yep. But that's how I learned what a red herring was. But two, question for you off the script. Have many people run adventures for you, or have you mostly run them for others?
I'm usually the GM for our group, but I mean, I've played, it seems like probably like a 70-30 split of like me running versus having played at this point, but I've played a lot of stuff though too.
Let's take a step back and ask a fundamental question then. Put yourself in this place. Like, oh, I'm gonna do the classic thing. All right, Tanner, close your eyes. You are about to enter a good friend's house. I don't know who the friend is, you pick, and they're gonna run a mystery game for you. What are you hoping to get out of this evening?
That's a great question. I want to feel smart, not stupid. And I feel like that's a very fine line when it comes to a mystery or a puzzle or something like that. You know, there's puzzles in like video games that make you feel stupid when you figure out the solution or mad, but there are puzzles that make you feel clever, and I want to feel clever, and I want to, you know, be able to get this clue over here and this clue over here and say, wait a minute, these don't add up. And you know, I guess that maybe I want there to be kind of like a mental puzzle, a puzzle box that I can kind of piece things together.
Do you feel any anxiety? And I'll confess, when we went to play this adventure and you were running a mystery for me, I was like, God, I hope I'm as smart as he thinks I is. I hope Tanner doesn't walk out of this game going, oh my God, Dusty's an idiot. Do you feel that anxiety at all when someone's running an adventure for you?
Not nearly as much as when I'm running. I feel like my anxiety for GMing is way higher than it is for playing.
That's fair. I had more anxiety around playing. My anxiety for GMing, I feel like I could, like the Columbo adventure, I was like, this is like 50-50. I'm not sure if it's going to go well. And it went okay. Not great, but okay, as you've heard. But I knew if it didn't go well, I could just be like, yeah, I made these structural mistakes putting it together. It never occurred to me that you there might be anxiety on your side of the table until I went to play in your game. And I was like, oh man, I hope I figure everything out.
That's super interesting. Yeah. I don't know. I whenever I run adventures for somebody who isn't my home group, I do try to kind of run it by somebody and be like, hey, I'm doing this mystery. It's kind of like this one episode of this one show where they kind of put together that there's a counterfeiting ring from these three things. Like, is that like clever enough? And you got the counterfeiting thing. As soon as I talked about the plates and the ink, you're like, oh, I figured out what's going on. And so like that felt good. And I'm sure that felt good as a player too, to kind of put that together. So I at least try to like run it by somebody. But yeah, I don't know. Mysteries are hard, man.
One more question and taking a step back thing. So again, close your eyes for the friend's house. You're hoping to feel clever. Got it. Are you hoping to feel clever in the way that you feel throughout a jigsaw puzzle where there's lots of moments of like, oh, this goes here. Oh, I finished the edge. Oh, I finished the puzzle. Are you looking for lots of little moments like that? Or are you looking for that one M. Night Shyamalan moment where, whoa, everything falls into place?
I think I'm looking for the big moment where I learn something and then the context of all the other information I have changes. Like that, I think, is like one of the coolest kind of moments you can have.
Interesting. I'm looking for the jigsaw puzzle.
Interesting.
I want to just get there piece by piece.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not looking for the big dramatic moment. I'm looking for a very workmanlike approach of just kind of getting there, because what's the point of an RPG? When you and I play a one-on-one RPG, it's not for anyone else's entertainment. We're not recording the game. We talk about it later, but we don't really recount our particular moments except for lessons we could learn. We mostly recount the bad parts. So we're not out to entertain anyone except for like ourselves. Right. So really the point of it is kind of the role play and coming up with a story and frankly building some memories for some things that just don't happen in mundane life.
Right.
And for me, I think the best memories come from enjoying every moment of the game, which is why I'm looking for constant little puzzle pieces instead of not enjoying the game until the very end when I get the one big reveal.
Yeah, I shouldn't say that I don't not enjoy mysteries until the big reveal. Like, I do have fun stuff piecing it together, but that's definitely the memorable part for me. If we're talking about, like, purely playing RPGs to make memories, like, that's the real big payoff for me. That's interesting. And like, the thing is that, like, I don't know, again, comparing mysteries to dungeon crawls, it's like, I don't, can you have this deep of a philosophical discussion about what makes a good dungeon crawl? Like, what's your favorite part of the dungeon crawl? I don't know. Mysteries are just such a different beast, I think, is what we're running into.
Yeah, it really is. They're both stories, but one is really
kind of emergent, and, you know,
it's not even that. I think in one, you are actively creating the events, and in the other, you're discovering the events.
Yeah, mysteries, I think, have to have this inflection point where you go from reactionary to actionary, or I don't know if that's a term, but, like, you have to, there has to be a certain moment between you piecing together what happened and asking questions and being kind of reactive to then doing something about it. And that inflection point can be pretty hard, I think, to nail down.
Yeah, and that inflection point, I think, is where we went awry with the combat.
Yeah. Yeah, so I tried to include a combat at the end because you tried to kick down the guy's door and confront him about what was going on. And Gumshoe combat, man, I think you're probably maybe the double digit person in my life who has told me that Gumshoe combat kind of sucks. You might be number 10. It's like, and I know this deep down, but, like, why do I feel so honor bound to play combat in the terms that Gumshoe wants me to play it instead of just narrating what happens? Why do I do that?
I don't know. I think because combat feels like it should be part of the tabletop experience. So many tabletop games, to quote Matt Colville, are about killing monsters. Matt Colville famously says over and over and over again, D&D is a game about killing monsters. And I think it can be tempting to extrapolate that out to every other TTRPG because D&D is such a big part of the hobby. But for me, a mystery game's over, not quite the moment you figured it out, but the moment you figured it out and you have proved it to someone enough that you know the suspect is going to get quote-unquote justice. That's right. When it's over.
Yeah, so maybe I should have just exercised some more restraint when it came to what I wanted a climax or finale to be. Like, I kind of always want one to be explosive and punchy, but maybe mysteries don't always have to be about that, you know?
And you know, dungeon crawls emulate low fantasy, right? Kind of the grim, dark, low fantasy, potboiler, event-driven, plot-driven stories. Mysteries obviously emulate detective novels. Serious question, man. What's your favorite mystery IP? Obviously, mine's Columbo. I've talked about it a gajillion times. What's yours?
I can only say this because me and my partner have been watching so much of it, but, like, the first 5 seasons of Castle on ABC are kind of a soft spot for me.
I watched a solid season of that and got really into it, and that was so long ago that I've forgotten almost everything about it.
That's kind of where I was at too. I'm like, I remember loving this, but I don't remember what happens in every episode yet, so it was kind of fun to revisit. But yeah, you know, it's about one person who kind of doesn't have any authority but is pretty sharp, and another person who is really sharp but kind of thinks within the box, you know, and the buddy cop nature of that was always kind of appealing. I don't know, maybe, like, would this have been better? So this is a one-on-one game, I'm not sure if I mentioned, but, like, would this have been better if it was a buddy cop thing, if we had 2 players and 1 GM?
No, I don't think so. No.
I tried to give you a pretty robust kind of supporting cast.
That was brilliant.
Okay.
That was super brilliant. Yeah, it's for I think one-on-one's the right way to run a mystery. I think a group would be harder, actually. But the supporting cast was phenomenal. What a brilliant idea. And then we had fun with it. I had fun with it. I need a real strong character to play, and I need things that are not like me to like latch onto and have fun with. And one of the, I think I like running gags more than I like character arcs. I don't want my character to necessarily grow. My character largely is who he is. And the running gag that I asked you, hey, Tanner, do you mind if we do this running gag? Was my guy was a total scumbag now and couldn't get a date to save his life. But clearly, like 5 or 10 years ago, he'd been some kind of like Casanova, because my ask was, hey, can basically like almost every woman we meet somehow be my ex that now hates my guts? Right. And you were like, which sure.
Which is very appropriate for a kind of seedy 70s cop show that, you know, maybe didn't fly today.
And I really enjoyed like having a running gag that we didn't laugh at, but that was fun to play, gave me lots of those little moments of fun throughout the adventure. And the supporting cast of characters played into that, because several of them were female characters that we were able to joke about. Fine, I'll help you this one time. Mm-hmm. But no, that was a lot of fun. The supporting cast was brilliant, and it gave me access in Gumshoe to a lot of skills that weren't on my character's skill tree. Because in Gumshoe, you need this really broad base of skills. And a perfect way to make Gumshoe one-on-one is to give me access to a couple of experts, kind of like Greg in the lab in CSI, that right. I can call upon and get help from.
Yep. Or like, you know, this person knows art history and history. They're at the University of Michigan nearby, and you can like, it makes sense that your character wouldn't know that. And it becomes a fun scene instead of you just saying, I use art history and I give you a clue. Suddenly that getting that clue becomes a fun little scene between me and you. And that's kind of an improvement, I think.
And you limited it. Like I could only call like what, like it was like a Who Wants to Be a Millionaire rules. I had like three phone a friends.
Yeah. I think like each person had like maybe 5 or 6 skills, but you could use like 3 points or like 2 points from one of them, except maybe your partner who had a couple more, but yeah.
Got it.
Yeah. So you feel like getting to the conclusion, learning some lessons, or is there anything else you wanted to mention?
Let's hit the show notes and make sure we've got everything. Was the game fun to run? Did you enjoy running this game?
I'll give it a solid kind of. I had fun coming up with the mystery. I had fun typing it out and laying out the adventure and thinking it through. But when it comes to mysteries for me, like I mentioned earlier, there's always this sort of anxiety at the back of my head that I'm really afraid of you running off the rails and latching onto the wrong thing I mentioned and stuff like that. So I think maybe that leads to my games feeling a little bit more boilerplate, because I really want the path forward to be clear. But either way, it just takes a lot of energy to keep it focused from my end, at least.
Difficult question, but I want you to be honest. Do you and I have good game chemistry? Because thinking back over this is the 11th, I think, episode that we've recorded. Thinking back over these last 11 episodes, a bunch of the games have been duds. Do you and I have good chemistry or not?
I think so. I mean, we kind of got together because I liked the way that you so frankly talked about your games, and, you know, you and I kind of got into talking and playing games because I liked your approach to analyzing and kind of, you know, not killing your darlings, but taking a hard look at kind of what you're doing right and doing wrong in an effort to get better at stuff. And I think that we're kind of tough critics after the game, but importantly during the game, I think we're both very understanding of one another, and we're really willing to kind of step outside the game and say like, hey, this isn't working, let's do this, and we'll kind of get on the right track if something like that came up, you know. So I think it kind of comes down to our in-game demeanor being understanding, and then kind of our out-of-game demeanor being more critical.
That's a great way to put it, because I end every one of our games with a big smile. Like, I am walking around the house smiling like an idiot, like, go grab a drink of water or whatever. I tell, you know, my wife about the game. And it's always fun. Like, even when we rate it, you know, 7 out of 10 or 6 out of 10, or as you said, a solid kinda. the game's fun. I think you're highlighting something, though, that I feel when I GM, no matter who it is. I'm so worried about making sure it's fun for them that I forget to have fun as a GM.
Yeah, and that's why I kind of like games lately that have more kind of GM facing kind of improv moments, you know, tools, things that are like Tanner, now their reaction role is that these two merchants are super mean to Dusty. And then I'm like, okay, how am I going to make that work? And that kind of becomes the fun for me in play, you know? So is there room for that in a mystery? I don't know, though.
I think what gives us that in a dungeon crawl is the procedural nature of a dungeon crawl. Mm-hmm. Hey, there's a role to listen at the door. There's a role to open the door. There's a role for traps. There's a role for reactions. There's a role for morale in the fight. And I think a narrative emerges from that. And it's giving both of us all these prompts to like play off of. And if things go terribly awry, if we're ever playing Scarlet Heroes and my character dies, I don't think I'm going to be like mad at you. I think we'll both just be like, well, we procedurally generated a story. We did the best we could to make it make sense by reacting emotionally and giving those procedural results emotional context. And if he dies, he dies. To quote Ivan Drago from Rocky IV, I think this is missing that.
Yeah, and I think that a lot of mystery writers, whether for TV or books, would really kill for an audience that believes anything could happen at any moment. But ironically, we kind of only get that in dungeons in play, don't we? Like in practice.
Do we still want to chase this mystery dragon?
I think so. I feel like I don't even have a good grasp on it yet, truly. And I would like to at least see where the summit is and see how achievable it is. Because right now I feel like we're having fun, but I do feel like we're not really having many true revelations about how to make them work better yet.
I still feel the way I feel in like the first hour of a Final Fantasy game, where visuals are pretty and gosh, that moment was kind of cool, but I have NFI what's going on.
Yeah, a lot of good proper nouns and crystals happening, but yeah, I'm not sure where this is going.
All right, so we hit that in the show notes. Let's see what else. The Lovecraftian twist, we've got that. The setting, did the setting come across? Yes.
Okay, good, because neither of us were alive in the 70s, so I kind of had a free reign to do a movie gritty version of the 70s, right?
Well, fun fact, neither of us were alive in the 1300s or the 1100s either. I think it's all about verisimilitude. And does it feel real? And I think we've both seen enough 70s TV, or I know I have, with the Columbo love that I often espouse. I got to play a seedier version of Columbo in Columbo's classic milieu, which is the mid-70s. I loved the setting. It came across great. I think you did a great job portraying the 70s. We didn't do like sideburns and mushrooms and marijuana and bell bottoms, but
I was doing all that on my end. I don't know about you.
But like seedy urban 70s? Yeah.
It was kind of like the decade where like urban blight really kind of hit, you know, Americana, and it was kind of the dream of the 60s dying. And at least these are the stereotypes that I was leaning into. And we even had some kind of interesting fallout from Vietnam War era stuff with the main suspect, right? He was an old Delta Green operative. So I tried to like kind of hook it into things that were real, at least.
The combat at the end. We've got a thing in the show notes that I really want to say out loud, which is, we don't see the CSIs kick ass in CSI. We don't see Sherlock Holmes kick ass, you know, with the notable exception of the Guy Ritchie films. Columbo, you know, never cuffs his suspect, never draws his gun, famously rarely carries a gun. Jessica Fletcher usually has a gun pointed at her by the murderer, but someone else intervenes and saves her. I don't see combat. Just the combat in a mystery just feels weird to me. I'm not sure there's a good way to layer in combat unless it's like a fighting mystery where the mystery happens the whole time throughout the combat. Throughout the adventure, it's kind of like a James Bond film,
mm-hmm,
where he's like gunfighting his way to the clues. Maybe that could work, but like saving the gunfight to the very end just seems strange.
Yeah, and I will say combat feels a little bit more... less out of place in Knight's Black Agents, which is the one about Jason Bourne fighting vampires. But even then, if you're getting into combat, it's kind of a mistake. Like it has almost an OSR kind of sensibility of like, you should set traps and you should never if you're fist fighting a vampire in that game, you've already messed up somewhere. So yeah, maybe I just need to have kind of that approach to mysteries as well. But yeah, I think, I guess let's get to the lessons learned. So lesson learned number one, ask yourself, does your session need combat? And yeah, in this case, I don't think it did.
For a mystery game. Yeah, not every game has to be about killing monsters. My wife has asked me over and over, hey, are there any RPGs not about killing things? And I'm like, not on my shelf.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And then but, also, next lesson learned, lean into a fun character. If I don't have a fun, you know, I'm not the world's best character arc person. I don't want to be. But I want to have a strong sense of who I'm playing, and I want to have a few running gags that I can rely on, like an old TV show. And the gags don't have to be like funny and take away from the game. They can add to the drama. I don't mean gag like ha-ha. I mean gag like, you know, kind of a running reference. But figure those things out and just like lean hard into a character for a one-shot and have fun with it. I had such fun with this character.
That's really good to hear. And then lesson learned number three, I bet this one will come up again. Mysteries are hard. We're still trying to figure out our formula for me and Dusty to make them work. And we have some plans to explore that in the future. But I imagine at the end of that session, we're going to say mysteries are hard. That's my prediction.
The last thing I want to say before we close out is we've been putting out episodes during all of the OGL drama and not saying anything about it. That's because we recorded those like before Christmas. Mm-hmm. Our last episode that you would have listened to, we would have recorded before Christmas, and we're recording this episode on February 3rd after all the OGL drama has ended. So if you've been like, gosh, why have Dusty and Tanner, my absolute favorite RPG podcasters, not been commenting on this drama? First of all, you should find some other favorite podcasters. But second of all, it's because we didn't have a chance to. We record so far in advance, and I'm not one for drama anyway.
Yeah, if us famously having our finger on the pulse of the industry. Yeah, go somewhere else for that.
We play old games for our own reasons.
Yes. I want to get a shirt that says that.
Thank you for listening. People call them postmortems, evaluations, appraisals, reviews, retrospectives. We call them lessons learned, and we're sharing ours with you.